is John Mad Dog Hall, but I just want to say that I had the privilege of meeting John Mad Dog Hall at KALU in 1999, and it was great to talk to him face to face. Great to hear him speak. He's a great speaker. Over 30 years experience, and you know, people say that Linus is the father of Linux. Well, if Linus is the father of Linux, then Mad Dog is the grandfather. Because you know what grandfathers are like? They carry around the photos of their grandkids and they're telling everyone about it. Well, that's what Mad Dog does. He tells everyone about Linux and open source, and he's a great guy, a great bloke, as well as really knowing his stuff. So I'd like you to put your hands together and welcome Mr. John Mad Dog Hall.
Oh yes, there we go. Screensaver. Okay. As you saw briefly up there, I've had quite a bit of experience in doing different things. And part of that was actually being a programmer at one time. Now, I was a programmer long enough ago that basically machines were measured in how many millions of dollars they cost and how many tons they weighed. And over the years, as I continued to work in various different places, I started to realize that there was a discrepancy between what I did and what my parents could understand. And recently, a book came out from a gentleman who was trying to describe the differences between the sexes. And that book, of course, was that men are from Mars and women are from Venus. And so I started thinking about this and said, this might make a good talk, trying to describe the difference between programmers and the rest of the people in the world. Now, again, when I was growing up, we talked about the different planets. And the planet that was the second furthest from the sun, we called it, well, today they call it Uranus. But we called it Uranus. And I think the title of this talk is that users and managers are definitely from Uranus. Now, my lawyers tell me, of course, that I always have to talk about the fact that Linux is a trademark of Linus Torvalds in several countries around the world, and we have to protect it as such. We've created a nonprofit organization called Linux Mark Institute, which registers the term Linux for anybody that wants to include that in their trademark. But if you want to put Linux on a t-shirt or a coffee cup or something, that's fine. You don't have to do anything special there. I'd like to point out that as far as I can find out in legal stuff, SCO doesn't even own the trademark for their own products. That's still owned by Novell. And Microsoft, of course, would like to own everything else. So the agenda here is several different views. And of course, like any good keynote, this is done with a great deal of... Can you turn down the volume of the... I'm getting a little bit of ringing back there. This is done with a great deal of opinion. You may disagree. You may have additional things to add. And all of that's fine. Just do it after the talk. Now, once upon a time, I worked for Bell Laboratories. And this is probably back in about 1970. And there was a joke that was being passed around back then that looked something like this. And how many of you have seen something like this, joke? Yes, everybody's seen it. But the problem is, it's true. And no matter what you do to try and solve the problem, it's still true. Because what companies basically want is one simple thing: to be profitable. I mean, from time to time you get a company that is profitable and they build a town for their people to live in, like Hershey. Or you find a company that's profitable and they give away millions of dollars, okay, to various charitable organizations. But the key word is profitable, because just as soon as they start to turn non-profitable, that's when everything goes downhill. And if you don't believe that, then you can take a look at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in the United States, where they were using water power to have a mill town to do milling. And they would invite young girls from farms down to this town because they were an untapped labor resource. And they said, well, you know, it's okay for you to come from your farms to this town, because we're going to set it up so that there's going to be opera, and there's going to be book readings, and there's going to be all this wonderful stuff. It's going to be a wonderful life, and you can work for a couple of years, get enough money for your dowry, and go back and get married and have a nice family. And this sounded reasonable. And that worked until other people started to develop the same thing, and there started to be competition with this town, and the profits started to disappear from the weaving, and all of the nice stuff went away. And, ooh, my battery's not fully recharged. But basically, a company has to be profitable, because when a company is not profitable, they go out of business. Now, in the Linux case, we've seen a lot of this, okay? Early companies that got into the business, I'll mention some names, I hope I don't embarrass anybody here in the room. Transameritech, Yggdrasil, you know, all of these different companies that first started to produce Linux CDs and Linux services, but they were simply before their time. And we had companies that today still struggle in the Linux marketplace, because when any company starts off, they typically are not profitable. They hire people, they have expenses, but they don't have any type of revenues, and consequently, their expenses are greater than their revenues, and they are unprofitable. Hopefully, over time, they keep their expenses under control, their revenues gain, and they become profitable. And this is something that has happened to Red Hat Software in the last couple of quarters. If you look at some of the other Linux companies, I hope very much that it happens with SUSE and some of the other distributions that are commercial distributions. But if that does not happen, then shareholders get a little bit peeved, and they typically fire the CEO. And before that happens, usually there are some layoffs and people are out of work, and taxes are lost. And so you see that through the entire infrastructure, we have people who are unhappy. Even the government's unhappy because taxes are lost and people are out of work. So we have to say to ourselves, what makes for a profitable company? Well, you hope that you can make a product at costs that are lower than your competitors, or a product which is better quality than your competitor, so that you hope that they will buy it over your competitor and maybe pay a little bit more money. You hope to produce it in volumes that you can meet the needs of your customers. There's such a thing as not being able to produce enough product for your customer, and so your customer goes some other place for their solution. In the Linux space, this could well be something as not having enough systems administrators to administer your Linux systems to meet the needs of a large company. That could be a reason why they don't use Linux. Or doing something in time frames that are needed by your customers. you know, they need something today, you can only supply it tomorrow. And all of these things are really based around customer satisfaction and customer loyalty. So what makes for good products? Well, one of the things that companies really like is what they call dependable time frames and roadmaps. Now, for the past week and a half, I've been traveling around the Asian Pacific Rim talking about a new product which is coming out from a company. And every place along the way, they were asking me, what is the roadmap of Linux? And I said, well, you know something, I don't know what the roadmap of Linux is. The only roadmap I ever saw was one that was done in May of 1995 by Linus Torvalds at an event. And he held up a graph and it said, world domination. So far, we're on track. But that is not enough of a roadmap for some of these people. They want to know when each feature is going to go into the kernel and when they can expect that the kernel is going to be ready for them. Well, one of the things I tell them is roadmaps come from companies that do all of their planning behind closed doors. Roadmaps come from companies where the engineers sit there and do everything in private, in quiet. And so about the only thing that these companies can share with their customers about what's happening in the future is this roadmap. In the open source space, if you want to see where things are going, you can look at the mailing lists, you can look at the websites, you can follow along with what's going on. And therefore, the need for a roadmap as such is less important. Good products also have either large volumes or large margins. Large volumes, we're well on our way to getting there. Large margins, we have some problems with. It's hard for you to create a large margin with free and open source code. That's the bad news for the vendors. It's good for the customers. When you create a proprietary closed source system, you are by the definition the expert in that and how it works. And therefore you can demand a premium on your services and your time. When you're developing open source code so that everybody has access to the source code, there's only so much that you can charge as a premium for your services, because other people have the ability to become almost as expert, or perhaps as expert, as you are in a particular field. And so open source opens up new markets and new ways of getting support and getting for your products and for your business that are not available with proprietary closed source software. Customer demand is another thing that makes for good product. It's nice when the customers ask about your product and say, please give me your product. For the first several years in Linux, we always had to go out and we'd say, we're selling Linux. And people go, what's Linux? And then you have to go through the whole thing about free and open source. Lately, there's been a lot more people who know what Linux and free and open source are. I probably wear more Penguin paraphernalia than most people do. And as I go running through the airport trying to catch my next plane, I may come up to a Burger King or something and somebody looks and sees Tux on my shirt and they go, oh, Linux! Or like it happened yesterday as I was going through immigration, they said, why are you coming to Australia? I said, I'm coming for a Linux conference. And the person who was checking me in didn't say anything. They said, oh, that's nice. And I went through, but the person sitting next to them turned around and said, there's a Linux conference here in Australia? He was a Mac OS user, but he knew about free and open source, he knew about Linux. So it's getting better. Product differentiation is also a little hard with free and open source, and you don't want to differentiate your product so much that you create a binary incompatibility with other distributions. Controlled innovation. These are other things that managers like. They want to see innovation move forward, but not in so much a way that it's radical for them, that they have to spend a lot of money in retraining their employees. And of course, they love to see upgrade paths. So all of this means that management basically likes plans. They love plans. They want to see plans. Never mind the fact that the plans that were made 3 years ago never happened. I have people still ask me, where is Linux going to be 10 years from now? And I say, please, how many of you 10 years ago would think that you'd be able to go to the far-flung places of the earth, sit there with your notebook in a Starbucks cafe, and transfer money back and forth in your bank account? If I told you that 10 years ago, you'd say, what's Starbucks? And so you see, it's very difficult to predict the future. And quite frankly, if anybody had told me years ago that I'd be able to wear on my wrist a machine which has the CPU power of the first 3 or 4 CPUs I ever programmed on, I'd say, my God, that watch will weigh a lot of... But management often does not understand technology. Maybe at one time they understood technology, you know, they had an idea, they formulated a company and so forth. But most cases, over time, the growth of the company forces the person who developed it either into a CTO position, not as the head of the company anymore, but or forces them out completely. And the people who take over are more managerial people, people who manage budgets and things like that. And they hire people as product managers who may not have the best idea of the technology. And consequently, the concept of pointy-haired boss takes on real meaning. Now, as I was going through life and watching how managers came into being, I created a set of laws, which I call Hall's Laws, and one which I developed rather late in life was the concept that it's easier to take an engineer and teach them business than to take a business person and teach them engineering. Many times I've gone through and said, we need another person in technical marketing or in marketing. And it's relatively easy to take an engineer who has good skills and teach them the proper way of reaching other people with their marketing messages. But to take somebody that has absolutely no technical background and try and teach them the highly complex world that we live in is practically impossible, in my feeling. So all of this is kind of why managers like reports, managers like planning, managers like timelines, managers hate our guts. So the things that go on in a manager's mind, customer lock-in, loyalty. Now, I know that there's this concept that goes throughout the customer base that proprietary systems were built to lock you in, right? Let me tell you something. That may have been the concept in the last few years, but in the very beginning, that concept was not there. Let me tell you why. In the very beginning, when the machines were very heavy and very big and had memories that could be measured in kilobytes instead of megabytes and terabytes, it was just enough to try and get your application to work on the machine in the first place. In the first several years, there was no operating system at all. The programs were written directly to run on the machine. You had the device drivers that controlled the devices built directly into every program. You had to squeeze every single cycle out of that machine because the machine was incredibly expensive and incredibly slow and incredibly small. When people started to develop operating systems, it wasn't to lock people in. It was to allow people to utilize those machines a lot more effectively. And so they developed their operating systems with two concepts. Number one, the architecture of the machine itself. What was a machine built for? What market was it trying to address? And the actual marketplace. Is it a business machine? Is it a scientific machine? Think about it. If this was not the case, why would Digital Equipment Corporation have 11 different operating systems on their PDP-11 line of computers alone? Surely one operating system would have been enough to lock their customers in. But they had 11 different ones because each one was tuned to a slightly different audience. And that's why the programming interfaces were different. It was quite radical in 1969 to come up with an operating system that would be portable across architectures and hopefully flexible enough that you could use it in a variety of different business situations. It was radical, and it was a time for that to happen because the cost of the machine was dropping to the point where you could afford to give up a few machine cycles in order to get the portability and save the training as you go between different machine architectures. So the concept of customer lock-in didn't really start to happen until Sun Microsystems kind of invented it as part of their marketing of Unix. So at first, it was by necessity, then by accident, and finally, by stupidity. Because people will still try and do that, still try and find the way of locking their customer in. But the thing is that the customers have gotten smart enough, at least most of them, to recognize this is a bad thing. Patents are good. This is what goes on inside of a manager's mind. They want to have as many patents as humanly possible for everything they do. And they use them as weapons. They use them as weapons against other companies, not the large companies, because you can't use your patent pool as much as a weapon against them. But they use them as weapons against small companies trying to enter into the marketplace, companies that do not have their own patent pool. This is another way of a lot of large companies keeping small companies from entering into business. And they also want to keep their engineers fully utilized, even so much to the point that they typically don't give them any training, nor do they give any time for things like vacation and sickness. Now, this doesn't happen in every company. There are some companies that are very good at providing for training and time off for engineers because they realize it's important. However, in the Linux space, we have a slight problem. And the problem is that a lot of the people who develop Linux and free and open source code are not paid by their management to do that. They're paid by their management to do other things. And consequently, when you try and go to a Linux conference, the company looks at that as, well, that's vacation time for you, isn't it? How many of you are here because your company sent you here and they paid for the whole thing? That's good. How many have to come here on your own dime? That's bad. So a few more things about management. We'll get on to the other people. Lawyers make a lot of money, and there must be a reason for that. And the reason for that is that typically they are the best way of blocking something to keep it from going forward and happening. There's too many people in the world, too many companies in the world, who have forgotten that lawyers are advisors. They're supposed to tell you what the risk is, and then that risk has to be managed like every other risk. We have an issue right now that SCO is trying to sue the Linux and free and open source community. That's basically what's happening, because they say that some of their code is in Linux. Now, we still have to see the full disclosure of that. I personally believe that Linux doesn't have anything in it that really belongs to SCO. However, they may come up with a legal argument that allows them to do that. When people come to me and say, should I still be using Linux? I'd say, to me, it's still a binary argument. Either there is code in Linux that belongs to SCO, or there is not. If there is not, then there is no problem. If there is, then we have a whole group of people who are sitting, waiting, and willing to rewrite that code and to remove it from the free and open source community. And therefore, to me, any type of risk that would come out of this is minimal. But you have to remind them that all of business is risk. And the fact that if they don't take that risk, they probably will be out of business in a short time. If you try and run your company without risk, you will lose. Likewise, finance people who come along and look at the profit and balance of each product oftentimes say no, they don't understand how a product fits in. And finance people are also people that you look at as advisors. It finally comes down to upper management to say whether or not you go forward. And if you don't believe me in any of these, just read Dilbert. Now we get to the fun stuff. Programmers. Programmers are simply too intelligent. It's true. They think that everybody in the world is just slightly less intelligent than themselves. Because if this wasn't true, anybody would be able to use the command line of a Unix system, right? It's so obviously, trivially easy to do that. They wouldn't be recognized. They want to be recognized for what their work, for what they've done, and how good they are. They want to create software which is elegant. Software which, you look at it, it's like a piece of art. It's just naturally a beautiful thing. You want to hang it on the wall. And programmers always start off with the words, it's impossible. It's going to take forever. No, it's just impossible. But that means it's a day and a quick hack. And it's just a one-time hack. And nobody will use it for a long time, and I'll rewrite it in something better and more elegantly later. Which, of course, never happens. Next week. Now, there's other things in a programmer's mind, and not all programmers. Documentation people are a lesser evil, okay? When I worked at Digital Equipment Corporation, we had the development people and the documentation people. And after a while, this got shortened to Devos and Docos. And they're always talking about each other, right? And I said to them one time, did you ever think to yourself, the documentation person is just another type of engineer? That was a horrible thought to the development people. But it's true. The documentation people are trying to engineer good documentation to allow people to be able to use the product. And then the quality control people were also a lesser evil to the developers, but they were not quite sure how. What are these people who show up right 3 days before you ship the product and say, this is a piece of crap. We have 500 outstanding problem reports and you haven't fixed a single one of them in a week. So everybody scrambles for the next week to get it all fixed and it goes out the door. If documentation people and quality people are lesser evils, manufacturing people really drag their knuckles on the floor. But nevertheless, in Digital Equipment Corporation, it was the manufacturing people who always seemed to get caught with the bag when the product didn't sell. Because they were the ones that you went to and you said, we're going to sell 50,000 of these things. And so the manufacturing people bought 50,000 power supplies and 50,000 CPUs and, you know, so many memory chips and so forth. And then 2 years later, they still had 49,500 left in the warehouse. And so after a while, the manufacturing people got this bright idea. They were just going to simply treat every plan we had with the words, I don't believe you. And when we said that we were going to produce 50,000 of them, they only said, well, we'll buy enough parts for like 20,000, and we'll see how things go. Nevertheless, they were highly intelligent people. One of the problems I ran into with some of my engineers was that they believed the field test was the time that you tried out new features. At Digital, we had, when we would go out to field test, we would have two field test periods. We would take our software for our say, VAX 11780 computer, and we would put it out to field test, and we would have 20 field test sites. And these people would put their code on there, and of course, it didn't work very well in the first field test. And so after a while, they would stop using it, they would turn in their bug reports, we would upgrade the software, and we would send it out again. And they would put it on their systems again. Unfortunately, maybe only 5 people put it on in the second field test. Some of our engineers believed that if they came back at the end of the first field test and said, we don't like the interface, that was a time where you would rip apart the code and put it all back together again with a different interface. They didn't understand that what you were doing, what you should be doing, is just simply fixing bugs. I'm happy to say that for the most part, from what I see in the Linux community, they understand this very well. That there is a functionality freeze that happens in your code, and then after that, you fix bugs. I think that's one of the reasons why Linux is so stable. So in the programmer's mind, in a lot of cases, they think that patents are good, and particularly when they're yours. Unfortunately, in proprietary places, a lot of times management pays you or gives you raises based on the number of patents which you generate. You generate patents, you write papers, that's all good for the company, and you get raises based on that. That's why a lot of people still think that patents are good. Patents are bad when there's somebody else's patents and they keep you from producing the code that you want to write. And I'm getting, I'm happy to say that more and more when I talk to people about patents, I'm convincing them why software patents are bad. Published papers are good, and particularly when somebody else writes them for you. I'm sure you're familiar with the concept that typically the best papers are written in the last 5 seconds before they're given. And you'll see me writing my paper for tomorrow tonight. And a programmer likes to have the cutest acronym for their project that they could have. It may not tie in at all with what the project actually does, but as long as it's a cute acronym, that's okay. Now this is the perceived end user. I know you in your minds. You think this guy is going to be using your code. Let me explain who this is. He was born in 1984. This person actually exists. He was writing in BASIC at the age of 6. He found out about Linux at the age of 12. He actually bought a copy of the Linux Journal and was reading it. And I'm happy to say he read an article about an article I wrote. And he said, gee, that sounds really neat. I'd like to know about it. He put out his own distribution at the age of 14. It's called Fat Linux. Maybe some of you have heard about it. A friend of mine named Jeff Gerhardt runs a internet-based radio station out of Chicago. And he heard about Fat Linux from some of his customers. And he pulled it down off the net. He tried it. It was great. What happens is it's simply installed into the FAT file system so that you didn't have to repartition your disk to use Linux. This was several years ago, so this was kind of innovative. He called up the developer and said, would you like to come to my radio show and give an interview? And the voice on the other end of the phone said, I'd love to do that, but I don't have my driver's license yet. Now he's at Ohio State going for his computer engineering bachelor's, and he already has plans to go on and get his MBA. He doesn't bother to get a computer science degree because he says anything in software he can learn himself. And that is the people we write our software for, right? But here's the real end customer. In 1984, when I was working at Digital, I wrote a paper about my mother and father and how they had this unique fear of anything electronic. Over the years, I'd bought them all these different presents, a microwave oven, an electric coffee maker, you know, all these different things, some of which only had 2 buttons on the entire unit. And they still couldn't use it. They don't read manuals at all. If there's a manual that comes with anything, I have to show up and read it to them. It's not that they don't know how to read, but they just don't read manuals. They don't want to know how the computer works. They don't care about the wonderful stuff underneath of it. They don't care about the elegant code. They don't care about God. All they want to do is work. The real end customer has arthritis in his hands. My father does have arthritis in his hands. And you know something? It's really hard for him to use a 3-button mouse. Because when my father goes to grab that mouse, he grabs it like this, okay? He's not quite sure which button his index finger is over. This is one reason why he keeps removing the little applets from the menu launch bar at the bottom. Because he thinks he's clicking on it to launch the application, and he's really clicking on the third button, which says remove it from the panel. Please do not put remove from the panel as a topmost default entry in the pop-up menu. Thank you. He speaks only one language, and believe me, it is not yours. Okay? No matter what you think, he doesn't speak the English language. Well, my father does, but if he's in Estonia, he doesn't. So if all possible, try and have a meaningful icon that goes along with it, so he has a rough idea as to where what's going on. They may be completely illiterate, but they're not necessarily dumb. There's a project in India called the Simputer. The goal of the project is that even completely illiterate people can use a computer. How would this work? Well, if you go to a little kiosk in a village, there's a picture of a fish on the screen. This village is by the sea. It does fishing. 2 days' walk away in town, they have a market for the fish, the dried fish. And so the fishermen fish for a while, they dry their fish out, then they put it on a wagon and they take it to the town. If the price of the fish in the town is low, they don't make any money. If the price of the fish in the town is high, then they make a little bit of money and they can continue fishing. So the little kiosk there in the town does a dial up, finds out what the price of fish is, and puts it on the screen when you touch the picture of the fish with a mouse. You don't have to know anything about computers. You don't even have to be able to speak a language. All you have to know is that fish equates to how much money is being charged or is being sold to the fish. But then again, they may be dumb. Or they may seem dumb. And my father, despite the fact that I've shown him 5,000 times how to log onto his system and use it, after 10 years of having a computer able only to read mail and launch mail, they barely understand how a light bulb really works. They don't have to. They flip a switch, it works or it doesn't. If it doesn't work, they put a new light bulb in. Now, slightly above that is the well-trained computer professional. When I was at Digital Equipment Corporation, we had an administrator who was sitting at the terminal, and I was in my office, and I heard this beep, beep, beep. A couple of seconds later, beep, beep, beep. Now, I've been out of the office for 2 days, and I listened to this beep, beep, beep for about 30 or 40 seconds. And I went over to their desk and said, "Why is that infernal racket keep going on?" And they said, "I don't know. It's been doing it for 3 days now." And I looked down at the bottom of the screen, and here's this little red light flashing. It said, "Virus alert." That person had inserted a floppy disk into their machine 3 days ago that had a virus on it, And that virus had now infected every single PC and Digital Equipment Corporation. Because that person hadn't been told that when that little red light starts flashing, they should immediately contact somebody because of that virus alert. The real end user customer has trouble separating the concepts of the operating system from everything else. It's just that the computer doesn't work. That's all they know. They speak in terms of the real world, the things that they are familiar with, the knobs and widgets. So if you can make your product reflect the real world to them, that's better. So we have two different types of end user customers. One of them is the corporate end user customer. They have different characteristics from the at-home user. The corporate customer typically has a relatively large installation with an IT staff. They give training to their IT staff to do things. I believe that the years 2004 and 2005 will be the time that the Linux desktop will come into the IT corporate world, because the corporations will train their IT professionals to put a tailored system directly on the desktop of their companies. Now, in large, and I mean really large IT installations, you do not install your own operating system. You do not install your own applications. In some places, you don't even have a CD-ROM or floppy disk on your system. They do not allow you, because a floppy disk or a CD-ROM is the way that you put viruses into the system. What happens is the system administrator completely installs the system, completely installs all the applications which you're allowed to use, which do not include Solitaire and Mines. And they bring this system and plop it on your desk and hook it into the network and say, use it. That's what happens. And I think that today, Linux is perfectly viable and usable in that situation. Smaller installations will have a consultant that comes in. If you're a lawyer, if you're a doctor, if you're a dentist, if you're a pizza parlor, whatever, you have somebody that you buy your system from, and they come in and they plop it on your desk and they say, use it. And when you need to have backup done, either they've shown you a very simple method of doing backup, or they come in and do the backup for you. Very small installations will just go down to the local PC store and get whatever they can get. I think we still have a little bit of time to reach this group of people. But the first two groups, again, I think that Linux is ready today, as long as we can train those people in how to put together a solution. But the home user is different. The home user gets their support from people in their church. My mother and father go to their church and they talk to people and say, does your system do this? And they come back and they say, no. Oh, you know. And they can't get any support out of people in their church. Sometimes they go to people in the community. They actually have a computer club at the retirement village where my parents live. And they go to the retirement community and they say, does your computer system do this? And the community says, no. Oh. The only reason my parents used Linux is because I come home once a year. And I make sure that their Linux system is doing what it should. The reason they use Linux instead of Windows is because at one time I put Windows on their system. And it would only work for about 2 or 3 weeks after I leave. Why? Because the people in their church and the people in their community would tell them bad things. And they would come to my parents' house and install software on there that even I have never figured out what the software did or was supposed to do. And so when I installed Linux on their system, I installed it so my father, all he has to do is turn the system on, it comes up, he clicks this icon, hopefully with the left-hand button, and it launches his mail and he does his work. I have never given them the root password, and they will never have it. And finally, of course, the place that the home user gets their support from is from their children. And this is the very last place that most people ask for support, because, of course, their children will simply say to them, "Oh, Mom and Dad, you'll never understand." So what do these people want? What do the end users want? They want simplicity. And when I talk about end user simplicity, I'm talking about even people like university presidents. I remember in the early days of Alteryx, we had a large university wanted to use Alteryx on campus. I went to talk to the president. And he says, "Do you have a mail handling system?" We said, "Yes." He said, "I want it to be simple." "Oh, well, here's a very simple one." He says, "No, you don't understand. I only want 3 buttons on it. Compose a message, and when I'm finished composing, to send the message. Read mail. Maybe forward a piece of mail. That's it. I don't want folders. I don't want to have a blue background and a red background, or I don't want any of that stuff. I want it to be very, very simple." Because his job was being a university professor, president, not tailoring mail. They want it to be consistent. They do not really like change for change's sake. This, I think, is a little bit of a clash between the free and open source community and end user customers. We're never really sure when our project is done. We continue to make it better and better. And for a lot of these people, it just means different and different. They want enough to be able to do their job, whatever their job is. But their job is not tailoring computer systems. And so progressive disclosure is a good way of doing this. If the university president has started up his mail and saw only those 3 buttons because there was an environmental variable in the background that said, "This person is a beginner." After about 6 or 8 months, you might change that environmental variable to say that this person is an intermediate. And a few more buttons might show up to give them the ability to tailor the project a little bit better. And finally, you could say to them, "This person is Linus Torvalds." You'd have a Torvalds variable. That's when all of the buttons show up. And a couple dancing penguins. We need local support, and we need not just contract support, but ad hoc support. And then on dreary days when they don't have anything else to do, we can give them those few distractions that allow them to try and put the backgrounds up on the screen and different things. So if you look at different projects, you've got XMMS as an example, which is a fairly complex interface, I think, for just playing a CD. But the front panel of it looks a lot like the front panel of a lot of CD players, and so it kind of gets away with it. You've got Emacs. Well, that's enough said about that. And then you've got OpenOffice, which is complex, but I think it's also very intuitive in a lot of things it does. Successful projects have real-world knobs, things that look like you use in every day. It's one of the reasons why SuperCalc, when it first came about as an electronic spreadsheet, was so readily accepted by people, because it looked like the spreadsheet that you typically used to do your everyday work, if you used such a thing. The Palm Pilot was another very successful real-world button thing. Even today, when you look at the Palm OS, the features that come with it are still the same basic features that people use and are relatively straightforward. Very few people read the manual for the Palm Pilot. They just pick it up and use it. But if you want to be able to find out how to use it well, that's when you go back and pick up the manual. Keep it simple, simple, simple. The TiVo, I know a lot of you have not seen that because I don't think you have the services here in Australia. Andrew Tridgell bought one and hacked the world out of it. But it's a very simple device for recording TV shows, and it utilizes a menu system and a TV guide system, much like you find in a regular printed TV guide. And it's an extremely simple device to program. It is the only electronic device that my parents have ever been able to use without my having to show them how to use it. All of the hard parts of setting it up are automated. It's a little bit like using a wireless network card with DHCP as opposed to actually assigning all the different variables. You just plug it in, go through a few simple setup menus, and it works. In the World Wide Web, it also was an extremely successful project. Even though it had something complex like hypertext markup language, when the end user used it, all they basically had to do was click on something that was underlined, and they knew that that would take them to another page. That was wonderfully simple, and they could use it. The search engine, another relatively simple device, and that all brought together the World Wide Web. I talked before that engineers like to pick out the proper name for something, the proper acronym. Great, do that. But please make it the right name. Make it something that people can identify with. XMMS does not cut it. AltaVista was a search engine that was bought out by Digital Equipment Corporation, and it was a very good one. We thought the name was fairly decent, right? Because it's the name of these mountains and everything else. But again, it didn't scream search engine at you. Neither does Google. But people like it. It's a funny name. It kind of rolls off the lips. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's in the OED. Because when you say, I'll just AltaVista it, it doesn't quite cut it. But if you say, I'll Google it, just rolls right off the lips. So with that, I would like to thank various organizations, Linux International for continuing to fund me, God knows why they do it, SGI, who pays my salary and helped me get here to the airline, to this conference by purchasing my airline ticket, IBM for this really cool laptop, which has traveled around the world so many times, I've lost track, and your community for its hospitality. Thank you very much. And finally, before I stop, I would like to say one more thing. I've known Linux now for 10 years. This is my 10th year in going around and talking to people around the world about Linux. And there's a lot of people who come up to me and, you know, want to have the picture taken with me or want my autograph or something like that. And, hey, that's great. I'm happy to do it. But it's occurred to me more and more that the people who really make Linux work are not standing up here on the stage, but are out there in the audience. And so today, I want you to do something for me, or actually tomorrow morning. When you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror, think to yourself, I am one of the most important people in the Linux community. Because you are. Thank you.